Good afternoon and welcome back to Open Air, KLW's radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm David LaTulipe, your host on this first edition of a fully virtual Open Air. I'll be joined in various ways by singer Ben Jones, composer Steve Hackman, to talk about their recent collaboration with the Alexander String Quartet. Arranger Randy Bass joins me from Austin, who also contributed to the project. He'll chime in as well. Ben is also involved in the recently rescheduled production of the 1954 musical The Pajama Game at 42nd Street Moon. We'll hear from the executive director, co-executive director of 42nd Street Moon, to see how they're doing, Darren Carollo. Also, I'll talk with broadcaster and actor Brian Copeland about his latest show, Grandma and Me, being rehearsed as we speak for At the Marsh. How will that be done? Well, artistic and executive director Stephanie Weissman will be on the line to tell us. Plus, Peter Robinson with some soothing spoken word to take the hour out. Stay with us. Such a pleasure to welcome back master of microphone, camera, and all kinds of things, Brian Copeland. Brian spent 5 years as co-host of San Francisco's Fox affiliate KTVU breakfast program, Mornings on 2, and 2 years hosting San Francisco's ABC KGO's Emmy Award-winning afternoon talk show, 7 Live. In 1995, KGO Radio premiered the Brian Copeland Show, the most listened to program in its time slot, reaching more than 100,000 listeners. Brian's other theatrical works include Not a Genuine Black Man, the longest running one man show in San Francisco history, his acclaimed play The Waiting Period, a story of combating depression, The Scion, a taken from the headlines tale of privilege, murder, and sausage, the critically acclaimed Christmas classic, The Jewelry Box, and The Great American Show as a collaboration with Charlie Veron, featuring monologues on life in the age of Trump. His latest, which we'll talk about shortly, is Grandma and Me. Welcome back, Brian Copeland.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to have something to do.
Well, thanks for taking time out of rehearsal as well.
Yes, David Ford and I are in rehearsal, and the way it works is we do it over FaceTime. I set up the tripod, and he's got his tripod, and he directs me, and we run scenes.
It's a brave new world. How are you coping, Copeland? I mean, you got it in your name. You must be doing well.
Yeah, I was kind of climbing the walls.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit stir crazy, but then at the beginning of this week, I changed my mindset some and decided that I'm going to use this as a writing retreat. That's how it is. I'm looking at it. It's just an extended writing retreat. I've got a play that I'm working on, another play for the Marsh I'm working on, as well as a play for San Francisco Playhouse, and I've gotten 40,000 words into a novel.
Well, you do have a lot to do then. That's good.
Yeah,
I'm certainly not bored. I feel myself pretty lucky in that there are plenty of things to do. I'm just our industry in terms of not only radio but the performing arts. Myself as a flutist, we both know colleagues on both sides of the footlights that are really going to be hurting from all of this.
Oh yeah, no question about it.
And I'm just hoping that. I really have a hard time seeing how there will be a sense of normalcy anytime soon.
Yeah, I don't see there being a sense of normalcy for quite some time. I was just reading before you and I came on the air just about how the economy looks and the forecasts that the economists have for what's going to happen as far as money in this country is concerned. And, you know, they're saying they don't expect this to be over until August. And then once this happens in August, then like all of a sudden you're going to flip a light switch and the theaters are going to be full again and the concert halls will be full again and baseball games will be full again. And it will be incremental. But even then, you're going to be talking about a lot of people who are out of work because there are jobs that are going to go away that are just not, unfortunately, they're not going to be able to weather the storm, the employers, and they won't be back. So it's going to have an impact on us for quite some time.
Indeed. You're right. It's not like flipping a switch and suddenly an opera production can go on.
No, it's not, unfortunately. And the grimmest prospect of this article I was just looking at is that they predict that in order for us to get back to where we were in January of 2020, it could be any time between 2021 and 2031.
Wow. It's really going to be a global reset button in so many ways. You know, I wish I had a hotline to some economist in Washington, because what do you think about this idea? Is it just a stupid idea? Everything that has a monthly payment is put on hold. It just stops. So not only do you not have to pay the rent, but the person that owns your building doesn't have to pay their mortgage. You don't have to pay your credit card bill. You don't have to pay your phone or your internet. Just stop.
And there are places that are doing things like that. You know, I was listening to you, Jason, before you and I came on, and the state of California has got a moratorium on rent and on evictions and on mortgages and the like. And I think that's a great idea because, you know, you had 6.6 million people file for unemployment again last week.
It's crazy.
So nobody's working. So I don't think it's a dumb idea at all. Everything is on hold until the country is no longer on hold.
Right. Well, you know, you have a very wise approach to retreating and concentrating on your art for a period of time. But, you know, one of your acclaimed plays, The Waiting Period, dealt with depression and the waiting period being the time that you were forced to wait for purchase of a gun because you're going to kill yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So this is some heavy stuff. And then you also had a show about monologues in the life of Trump. So were those created as coping mechanisms, and did they help?
Actually, they weren't. Well, I take it back. The Great American Bleep Show was created as a coping mechanism because of all the frustration of dealing with and watching the Bleep Show that is our national government right now, that is the Oval Office. But pretty much the other stuff, like Not a Genuine Black Man or The Waiting Period, were things that were in the rearview mirror by the time that I was able to write about them and talk about them publicly. Otherwise, I would have been able to. I can't write about or talk about or create something that I'm in the middle of. It's got to be behind me in order to do it. You know, and it's funny that you mentioned that work, because one of the things I've been doing in terms of coping with being here and being alone, and I am a performer, is I have been doing performances over Facebook the last couple of weeks. I did two readings of Grandma and Me, where I just, you know, I set up my tripod on my with the iPod with the I set my tripod with the iPhone in it and sit at the dining room table and just read the script to 1,000 viewers. And then last Saturday night I did Not a Genuine Black Man from my family room for about 2,000 people. So, which is really kind of surreal to think that's a huge audience that's watching that show, most of whom have never seen that show, from all over the country, and I'm standing in my family room. Wow. I'm going to do it again at 5 o'clock this Saturday night right on my Facebook page.
Fantastic. Well, you found at least a partial solution to having the expression that we as artists need to exude.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Grandma and Me, your latest.
Well, Grandma and Me has a subtitle, which is an ode to single parents. And where that came from is my grandmother raised me when my mother passed away when I was 14 years old. And my sister was storing all her things, and we were going through her stuff a couple of years ago. And we came across the paper that gave her custody of us, gave her guardianship of us. And there were five of us. And we were ranging in age from 1 to 14, five, and she was 57 years old with a Jim Crow Birmingham, Alabama education. And the enormity of what she had done hit me at that moment. I hadn't truly understood it, you know, being a child, again, as I was telling you about things have to be in a rearview mirror for me to be able to write about them. But the enormity of what it is that she took on, the fact that she was willing to do it, and how she pulled it off, and what she was thinking, I thought would make a really great story, especially when juxtaposed with 2001, which is when I became a single parent, where I had three. My three were first grade, fifth grade, and seventh grade, and I was the custodial parent. And so I wrote this play that goes back and forth between the two periods, the past informs the present, and how it is that single parents do what it is that single parents do, and especially how single mothers are viewed by this society.
And all these experiences that you had growing up, I can imagine the stories that are going to be told just based on these next this year and the forthcoming years. It's going to be some rich and tragic material. And I'm hoping you're seeing the good in what Grandma brought you, of course.
Of course, absolutely. And I've done several readings of it, and we were scheduled to open at the Marsh on the 4th, but something happened, some virus or something. Unfortunately, it's been postponed indefinitely.
Well, you were supposed to be on a run through April 25th for Grandma and me at the Marsh. And here to talk about how things are going to move forward at the Marsh is Stephanie Weissman, if you can stay on with Stephanie for a moment. Stephanie has...
Hi, Steph.
Hey, Brian. Hey, David. Thank you for having us on.
Of course. Let me give you a little shout out for Stephanie. You've been our artistic executive director of the Marsh since its inception back in 1899.
That's what it feels like.
It may feel that way before the year's out, that's for sure. Under your leadership, the Marsh has grown from a one night a week performance series to some 700 shows or so annually on its four stages, maybe a few less this year. Stephanie, can you maybe tell us how the Marsh is surviving?
Well, you know, we're at about 75% earned income from our ticket sales. So
Ouch. Survival,
you know, we're going to need a lot of help. But we have transferred onto we start our transference onto the Zoom tonight. So it's been quite an amazing experience, because, you know, I had hoped to get more and more into digital, but when you do over 600 shows a year and you have a youth program and the classes and everything like that, it kept kind of pushed to the side.
And now you had to jump in the deep end. And now you have to jump into the deep end and do it.
Yeah. So we've just done it, you know, like I've come up with a new name for myself. It's like I'm crack quarantine. So, it feels like I've never been as busy in my life, but I can't tell you how many times I've said that, but I'm so busy. And all of a sudden we're just making this thing happen. And it is so exciting and so much fun amidst all the horror.
Well, you are making, certainly brightening my day after having to listen to the news all morning. And seriously, I finally have a smile on my face for the first time in many hours. So thank you, Stephanie.
So glad. And hopefully you'll listen tonight to our premiere show. It's called Stephanie's Marsh Dream.
I love that name, by the way. Marsh Dream, I just love that name.
Thank you.
And Steph, go ahead, Steph. Go ahead.
No, ask.
I was going to ask you, you've known Brian since he started these Marsh shows, I imagine.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, I started the shows with, if it weren't for Stephanie, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. You know, I came into the Marsh with this crazy idea about doing a show on racial discrimination and suicidal depression. And she said, okay, go ahead. David Ford said, go ahead. And that became Not a Genuine Black Man. It would completely change my career. Were it not for Stephanie, I wouldn't be, my career would have taken a completely different trajectory than it took.
Wow.
Well, believe us, we are so glad it did, Brian.
Thank you.
Very sweet. And Brian, I wish you luck on your virtual shows. I'll tune in myself. Look for Brian on Facebook and go to themarsh.org for the virtual Marsh project that Stephanie Weissman's involved with. Brian, Stephanie, thanks so much for taking some time today with me.
All right, you take care. Thank you. Right. Stay healthy.
Be well. I'm David LaTulipe. You're listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. Before the hour's out, Peter Robinson, my regular contributor, will be offering some spoken word for solace and reflection. I'll also be talking with the executive director of the 42nd Street Moon and with Ben Jones, Randy Bass, and composer Steve Hackman. Here's a preview of some of the work that they've been doing. That's the beautiful voice of Ben Jones and Dreams, the fourth movement from composer Steve Hackman's Dream Cycle. A five-movement work with settings of poems by William Blake, Robert Frost, Langston Hughes, and William Ernest Henley. Both composer and singer join me virtually today. Singer Ben Jones has appeared as soloist on stages, well, at least until recently, around the country and around the world, in musical theater and operatic settings in such varying principal and supporting roles in L'Enfant et les Sortilèges, Boris Godunov, Candide, Guys and Dolls, Follies, Showboat, The Last 5 Years, Chicago, and Cats, and stuff like that. He's also an alum of Beach Blanket Babylon. He's appeared with the great American symphony orchestras, such as San Francisco Symphony, the Seattle Symphony, among many others, and has shared the spotlights with the likes of Michael Tilson Thomas, Frederica von Stade, Nathan Gunn, Val Diamond, and the Bang on a Can All-Stars. And let's not forget commercials for Coors Light and Meow Mix. Ben Jones, thanks for joining me from New York.
What a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I should call you Ben Zelig instead of Ben Jones after that introduction. I believe we have composer Steve Hackman with us. Well, he's been a daring voice among a new generation of classical musicians intent on redefining the genre as composer, conductor, producer, DJ, arranger, songwriter, singer, and pianist. He uses those wide-ranging abilities to sort of blur the lines between high and pop art, say synthesizing Brahms and Radiohead, Bartok and Bjork, you know, stuff like that, and interpolates Verdi and Debussy into hip-hop tracks. Among his many global activities, Steve serves as creative director of the Indianapolis Symphony's Happy Hours series, one of the most successful millennial-focused concert experiences in the country. This is Ben Jones and Steve's first collaboration with the Alexander String Quartet. Steve, welcome to Open Air from New York as well.
Hey there. I'm actually in Venice, California.
You're in Venice. Okay, I didn't notice the prefix there. Well, welcome wherever you are. That's the beauty of a show like this. It's like a brave new world. You could be anywhere. The magic of radio. So both of your, you guys' schedules have been slightly interrupted. I mean, Ben, this was supposed to be a very busy time for you out here. You had an April 20th date at Feinstein's at the Nikko. They're hoping to reschedule that. You were going to be a soloist for the Sing for America benefit concert. That you were going to be with Livingston Taylor this month as well. Hopefully another concert date is going to be worked on for that. And we were so looking forward to, and I guess we will a little bit further down the line, the 42nd Street Moon production of The Pajama Game. So a big disruption in your life.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that there's ever been a time when I've lost so much work, so to speak, all at once. but I'm not alone there. I know that there are quite a few performers out there that are feeling the pain right now of what's going on around the country and around the world. You know, like your previous guest, just happy to have something to do today. So thanks for having me.
Of course. Well, geez. And that's not only a financial burden that's being placed on you, but an emotional connection with audiences, which we all are missing at this point.
Yeah, it's particularly depressing, I think, for those of us who really thrive on that that applause that we get when we appear live. Steve's no stranger to that, certainly. And you yourself, David. So, I think like your previous guest, you know, we're all kind of looking for ways to connect with our audiences online right now, over the radio as well. It's not easy, but I think we're going to come out of this having made some new connections and some new ways of performing, perhaps, and collaborating online with other musicians.
Well, I appreciate the optimistic viewpoint on that, and I want some of the pills you're taking to make that reaction in my own life. No, but to top it off, Ben, with having such a positive attitude, you and your wife are just coming off getting over COVID.
Yeah, that's right. I won't go into the gory details too much, but I'll just say, you know, it's not for the faint of heart. Like so many New Yorkers, we unfortunately caught it and had to isolate at home, and we're still obviously social distancing and all that. But, you know, with a 5-year-old daughter at home, trying to kind of figure out ways of steering clear of her, but keeping her busy throughout the day while my wife and I both battled the virus. And to make things just slightly more interesting, my wife is 8 months pregnant. So, we had all kinds of scary calls with doctors and things just to make sure everything's fine there.
Wow.
The good news is we're both, on the upswing, so to speak. So feeling much better after about 2 weeks taking turns in bed and dealing with the symptoms of the virus. Happily I sang for the first time yesterday. I hope that my lungs continue to come back to what I consider to be 100%. Nice to be feeling better.
Well, I think you might be recruited as a lab rat, for gosh sake, for going through all this and getting through it and persevering and not spreading it among the rest of your family. So you may well be a test case for what may get us all out of this. So please keep healthy and as well love to your wife.
Thanks for that.
A dear friend of mine, Darman Meter, who's a lead singer and arranger for the New York Voices, came back from a tour just before all of this started, didn't know what was going on, gave it to his wife when he got home. And they've been suffering through this and documenting it on Facebook with some very humorous and creative videos. So they're love to them in New Jersey as well. So let's talk about this positive collaboration with you, Steve, and the Alexander String Quartet. How did that come about?
Well, it was the convergence of, the stars aligned, basically. I became friends with a couple of members of the Alexander Quartet. We sang some Copland transcriptions, actually, that an oboist had done. I should say we played. I sang and they played it was through that connection over Copland that we all kind of said, hey, we ought to do something else together. And so, Steve and I have been friends for a long time. I hesitate to say almost because it'll date us, but 2 decades we've been friends. And I knew at the time that Steve was working on a particular commission for another setting. And I asked him, hey,
you know, is there anything that you could maybe write for string quartet and voice? And this dream cycle is what resulted. I don't want to talk too much about the writing because you've got Steve on as well. But let me just say, you know, it's an incredibly rewarding experience to not only, you know, get to sing a piece of work that a dear friend has written, but to get to take it straight into the studio with such great musicians as the Alexander Quartet and to record it. It was incredibly enriching and rewarding. And, you know, it's a very challenging new work, but I think a great addition to the canon of music for this setting. So, you know, my thanks to Steve for writing this, and I certainly hope everybody really enjoys it.
Well, Steve Hackman, let's talk about the inception for this work, Dream Cycle, and the poets involved.
Absolutely. I'm sorry, did I interrupt you there? Sorry.
No, not at all. We're hoping that you will now talk about how Dream Cycle came to you, into your dreams, perhaps, and the poets involved that you decided to use.
Sure. Well, like Ben said, it is a convergence. And, you know, there's another kind of central figure in this besides the three parties we're discussing, and that's Dr. Barrington Coleman, who was both Ben and my conductor in our undergraduate years at the University of Illinois. And that's where we, of course, met. And Dr. Coleman we were very close to him, and we've been friends through the years. And he had asked me to write some music for the 20th season with the Glee Club. Ben, is that right? 25th? Maybe 20th. And we just started talking about ideas for a piece. And he, you know, he said, there's a few texts that I've always had in my mind that he thought would make for great choral pieces. And one of them was the William Ernest Henley. And one of them, he spoke about the writing of blanks and hues in general, no particular works. And he just kind of threw that out there as thinking these might make for nice settings. And I just kind of went with that and wrote and added the Robert Frost and did some choosing on the lengths and hues. And then when Ben came to me with this project idea, I thought, we both kind of thought, would this be possible to, you know, retranslate those pieces for solo voice? And this is a total pleasure. And, you know, Ben's voice, as he said, you know, we've been great friends for so many years, and his voice has a special place, honestly, in my artistic development. I mean, in many ways, we sung in undergraduate together. He expanded the possibilities of what we were doing in the a cappella world. He sung on my graduation recital at Curtis. I mean, just so many instances I can think about where his voice just expanded the horizons for me musically, and he's done it once again with this piece.
It's an incredible voice, Ben. I think you know how much we appreciate the beauty that you bring to any of your projects, and such a pure tenor, high tenor that I've is a rarity. I had the great pleasure of hearing you recently in the fair city of San Antonio, Texas, performing a work about the Alamo. So it's a great pleasure to hear you, however you make your voice heard, and hopefully in full voice soon again. So that first cut we heard, Steve, we heard cycle from the cycle movement for Dreams. Who is the poet for that?
That's a Langston Hughes.
That's the Hughes. Okay. And I'd like to go out with you while we still have you with A Dream Pang, the second movement. Can you tell us a little bit about the poetry in that?
Absolutely. This is some Robert Frost. And just a kind of a wonderful impressionistic piece of his. And my writing, it really steered my writing into a sort of Ravel, sort of Debussy, a concept of a wash of sound and shifting harmonies that are shifting back and forth between this kind of semitone. This was a great challenge for the string players. You know, something like this works really well on piano, but you know, for a string quartet, it's quite difficult. So, you know, they did a tremendous job learning these pretty fiercely hard parts.
from Dream Cycle, A Dream Pang, poetry of Robert Frost. Here's Ben Jones and the Alexander String Quartet with the music of Steve Hackman. Ben Jones singing from Dream Cycle, A Dream Pang, with text by Robert Frost, music of Steve Hackman. And the Alexander String Quartet. Ben, that is such a you should be very proud of that. That sounds spectacular.
That's so nice of you. There's a lot of praise being rained down on me on this call today, so I appreciate it.
Well, you need some good, everyone needs a little bit of a pat on the back now and again, and I'm happy to offer this one. We're joined by in Austin by Randy Bass, who also collaborated on this production. Let me see if I can get Randy on the line. Randy, are you there?
I am here.
Randy, anticipating frogs coming down from the sky, I believe, in Austin
about now. Yeah, we're having one of our Central Texas weather events. I haven't seen Margaret Hamilton on a broom yet, so I guess we're all right.
Some thunderstorms coming through.
Yeah.
I wish you well wearing it through this. And Austin, tell us a little bit about the scene in Austin right now.
Well, it's probably much like it is in other places. It's very quiet. There's a lot of people in cars, not too many people walking around. I saw a short movie that somebody made here about it, and they went around and took pictures of the emptiness, and it was really striking. It's very eerie. It's kind of like being in the Twilight Zone and Groundhog Day all at once. Mm.
And, of course, South by Southwest was canceled. That was a tremendous big deal.
Yeah, it was. That was almost a month ago that they did that. And I think the city of Austin probably lost $500 million from that, so they said. And lots of people were hurt by it. I don't really have much to do with it as a classical, mostly classical musician, because it's mostly other kinds of music. But a lot of people that I know have had issues, especially people that have restaurants and things like that, because they've all been stood down or they're doing things differently than they used to.
Yeah, the restaurant industry, I think, especially, is going to be, if most of these restaurants recover at all, it's going to be a long, slow road. So everyone needs to support folks that are offering takeout or pickup if you can at this difficult time.
Yeah, I bought some gift cards actually and given them people, so they have the money in their pocket and can be redeemed later.
That's a great idea. What are you working on right now?
I'm doing some orchestrating right now. I'm not composing anything at the moment, and I'm trying to learn a new piece of music software, so I have to have stiff drinks around.
Don't we all right mm-hmm. about now?
Yeah.
The only thing that's flourishing right now is our wine cellar, or at least our wine collection in the garage.
Well, mine's getting smaller.
I considered it a necessary food run to go up to Sonoma and pick up a few cases. So.
Well, you can do that. We can go nearby here to Fredericksburg, and other places have lots of good wine cellars, but I don't know. I had some laid away. So far, I'm all right.
All right. Well, stay healthy. Tell us a little bit about the arrangement that you did that Ben, we have Ben on the line as well.
Hi, Ben.
From Britten's Corpus Christi Carol.
Yeah, it was not a piece I knew, actually, but he sent me the piece, and I listened to it. It's a solo piece in several different keys. There probably have been other arrangements of it done for ensembles. I think there's a choral version. I've not heard anybody do anything with string quartets, so I played through it a few times, listened to a few performances of it, and then started listening to my inner ear what four string players would sound like, weaving around these harmonies while Ben's voice was floating up above them. So actually not always above them, but certainly on the top of the wave. But it's a beautiful piece, and it's a pretty, I think it's kind of a youthful piece of his. It's something he wrote when he was young. But it's lovely, very simple, very clear, open sounds. So it gave me an opportunity to write that kind of texture for these remarkable string players who did a fabulous job with it.
And Ben, thank you for introducing this piece to me as well. How did you first hear this work by Britten?
Well, oddly enough, I was introduced to the piece when I heard Jeff Buckley's seminal album from 1994, Grace. It's the only studio album that Jeff Buckley recorded. And oddly enough, in the middle of this tour de force of rock singing, he put this track, this cover of Benjamin Britten's Corpus Christi Carol.
Huh.
And I believe it's a piece that he had sung as a boy soprano, because as Randy mentioned, the Britten setting of the text is a choral arrangement. And it's a part of a much larger work. It's just one sort of little blip in this otherwise kind of sprawling Britten piece. And it stood out so much to Jeff Buckley that he recorded it, just himself playing the guitar and singing in his very boyish falsetto as an adult man, though, and put it on this album, the only album that he, like I said, ever released. And so, you know, that album had such an impact on me. And again, when the Alexander Quartet and I were looking for things to collaborate on, I asked Randy if he would do an arrangement of this little piece. I don't even think it's 2 minutes long. He said, sure, I'll take a look. And we came away with something that I'm incredibly proud of. And, you know, it's just with all of the Britten that I studied and sang through the years, I sang the serenade for tenor, horn, and strings on my graduate recital from the San Francisco Conservatory, and other Britten works. Just a pleasure to have laid this down And you know what I'll add? We did it incredibly quickly. I think we were about to take a lunch break on the last day of recording with the quartet and the producer, Leslie Ann Jones, who is a Bay Area powerhouse multiple Grammy award-winning producer. She, you know, I'll never forget. I think she came over the headphones and said, "Hey, folks, would you try a couple passes of this Benjamin Britten piece?" And we came away with this recording that, like I said, I'm just couldn't be more proud of. And so thanks to Randy for arranging it.
Let's have a listen now. This is the Corpus Christi Carol by Benjamin Britten, as arranged by Randy Bass, Ben Jones, and the Alexander String Quartet. Randy, thanks for taking some time from Austin today and button
You're
up your
welcome.
Overcoat. Take
okay.
care.
Yeah, I'm going to go get my boat out, make sure it's seaworthy.
Corpus Christi Carol, music of Benjamin Britten, sung by Ben Jones with the Alexander String Quartet. Ben, I can barely speak after that. It's so beautiful. Thank you so much.
What a pleasure. Thanks for having us on the air.
And you're listening to the Ben Jones Show on, open air, that is. It should be the Ben Jones Show today, and rightly so, given the beautiful work that you've been doing lately, Ben. BenJonesSinger.com for more information. Among the very versatile hats that Jones puts on is musical theater actor. He was to be playing Sid this very month in the 1954 musical The Pajama Game. That's been postponed. And here to talk about that production, as well as the role of Sid and what's happening at 42nd Street Moon, is the executive director of that wonderful organization. He's been a leader in the Bay Area art scene here for over a decade and associated with many of the more prominent theater companies around the country. Darren Carollo, welcome to Open Air, and thank you for taking a little time today.
Thanks for having us. And I, too, want to say that it's the most glorious voice I've heard all week. So to listen to Ben is to understand why we cast Ben. I mean, that voice is glorious, whether he's singing opera with a string quartet or singing Lonely Town or singing any musical theater or American Songbook classic. You know, it's an interesting time at 42nd Street Moon. We would have had our designer run for Pajama Game last night. For those that don't know, that's a chance for all the designers to watch a run-through of the show to make sure we know where every light cue is going to go, where every sound cue is going to hit, every moment where scenery is going to move. And so it's nice to be in conversation with Ben, despite the fact that we haven't been in rehearsal together for the show. Moon is excited to present Pajama Game. We did not want to, we didn't want to cancel any shows where we had committed to artists. So we managed to postpone the last two offerings of our season, the Pajama Game, and then Merrily We Roll Along in rep with the Kaufman and Hart play, Merrily We Roll Along. So grateful to Ben and to all of our cast of Pajama Game. 12 of the 14 were able to take the postponed dates in August and September.
That's fantastic. And it's such a pleasure for me to discover some of these great musicals of the 50s, courtesy of a wonderful company like 42nd Street Moon. The premise, labor troubles in a pajama factory where workers' demands for a 7.5 cent raise are going unheeded. It's it kind of history repeats itself, don't you think?
You took the words out of my mouth. Beautifully said. I mean, we try to choose shows that are still relevant. We try to choose shows that have artist appeal. We try to choose shows that reflect the community of San Francisco, to be as diverse as our city is. And we wanted to go back and look at Pajama Game for a number of reasons. I mean, and Ben can talk a little bit about this should he want to, but Sid is a tricky role because he's often thought of as a chauvinist or an overly confident human. And I actually don't see it that way on the page. And I don't see it that way with Ben in the role, because there's a heart and there's a humility and a lovability in Sid. And he wants what's best for his career. Sure, who doesn't? You know, we just finished Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, where a character kills off 8 people to do what's best for his career. You know, at least Sid goes through it in a nonviolent way. So wanting the show to be relevant, and we try to do a dance show every year. And we're really excited about this show because of the choreographers assigned to the show. They had already done enough prep work that all of the actors had videos of them doing the choreography in their studios. So the process was certainly started and only temporarily paused at 42nd Street Moon.
Well, let's have you both on again to talk more about both 42nd Street Moon's surviving this and the production that's been now postponed. Now for August 19th to September 6th. We'll talk about the show in a little bit more detail. Unfortunately, I've got to go on to my next and final regular contributor, Peter Robinson, but we'll go out with just a touch of Hey There, a tune I didn't realize was from the Pajama Game. I thank you both for joining me, Darren Carollo from 42nd Street Moon, and Ben, keep on keeping on, would you, brother?
Yep, thank you so much for having us, David.
Sure.
Great to hear from both of you. Be well, Ben. Be well, everyone. Take care of each other.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes. Love never made a fool of you. You used to be too wise. Hey there, you on that high flying cloud. Though she won't throw a crumb to you, you think someday she'll come to you. Better forget.
Great tune from 42nd Street Moon, more accurately from the Pajama Game. We'll have more of that great music once the show is up and running later this season. Joined now by my regular contributor, Peter Robinson, for an abbreviated version, I'm afraid, Peter, of some spoken word solace. How are you faring, Peter?
I'm doing good. So, hey there, David, and thank you again for bringing all this variety of culture into our living rooms. We certainly need everything from Benjamin Britten to the pajama game. And what I'm going to talk about just for a few minutes is if you have been viewing movies and if you've spent your time at home and you've been looking at different films, I've got a couple of suggestions as to how you may make the different sorts of movies more meaningful. And what I'm going to talk about is categories. You know, for example, if you're a Jane Austen reader and you liked Pride and Prejudice, since 1938, there have been 17 different versions of Pride and Prejudice, starting with the great Laurence Olivier playing Mr. Darcy, down to a more recent one where Keira Knightley played Elizabeth and Colin Firth was also in it. So if you're going to revisit movies, you may want to set up a category and see how different periods at different times chose to depict what was indeed a familiar story. Another area I thought I'd check out is if you like a character. For example, if you like Philip Marlowe in the Raymond Chandler stories, over the years there have been 7 different Philip Marlowes: Dick Powell, Humphrey Bogart, Robert Montgomery, George Montgomery, James Garner, Elliot Gould, Robert Mitchum. And Raymond Chandler himself actually depicted his best Marlowe in the character of Dick Powell. And I say it because I'm definitely biased. I did like The Big Sleep. I did like Humphrey Bogart. And, of course, I did like Lauren Bacall. So those are a couple of different ways where, rather than just going for a movie, you decide you want to explore a particular genre. One other category, totally different. If, for example, you had an interest or you were involved in the war in Vietnam, there have been a remarkable number of very different styles of film just depicting the story of Vietnam, from Platoon to Apocalypse Now, Full Metal Jacket, or The War at Home, The Deer Hunter, or Born on the 4th of July. And, of course, there's the humorous side with Good Morning, Vietnam. Now, when I was doing this sort of research, I was surprised to see that one of my favorite both books and stories and movies about Vietnam, Graham Greene's The Quiet American, was not included. And I think that's of particular interest because there were 2 very different versions made of the book, one in 1958, which had a very classic American twist to it. They changed Graham Greene's story and effectively put America as the essentially good guys. And then in 2002, a remake with Philip Royce, also the same title, this time Michael Caine playing the central character of Thomas Fowler. And that version of The Quiet American is the one that I would suggest. So during these times at home, when somehow we want to distract ourselves from what's going on outside, and we return to the silver screen, it's useful, or it has been for me, to think of how different filmmakers have told different stories, and how, to some extent, history is revealed or learned by many people through the movies. And that's what I thought was interesting with the Graham Greene, The Quiet American. If ever there was an oxymoron in a title, that was the oxymoron, The Quiet American. And how 2 different filmmakers, one in 1958, could tell us one story, and then another in 2002 could tell us in many ways a totally different story. The key character, apart from Fowler, Pyle, of course, turns out to be a CIA agent. And again, we're into the world of spooks and espionage and history, sometimes as truth, sometimes as propaganda. So next week, I'm going to pick up a little, because you've just been talking about the pajama game, and I'm going to look at the golden age of the American musical and look at how the stories got turned into music, how the songs in the musical actually moved, in many cases, the story forward, and how the talking picture genre coincided with the great age of the American musical and, in many ways, the great age of the American songbook. So in between, although it may be dark on the outside, if you return to the silver screen, there is that quiet moment of escape. Flick the picture, up comes the actors, and suddenly we're into Tinseltown, and we've got Hollywood's story of a different world, but also a useful insight on history, because in many ways, the silver screen is very much the story of this country through the lens of a camera with a director and an actor telling it to you. But I just want to finish by saying again a big shout out to you, David. I think through Open Air, you're keeping us all in touch and you're connecting us and you're taking us away from some of the doom and gloom and understanding how culture, whether it's in a piece of music, a book, or a movie, can, at times like this, enrich our lives and help us to have that sense of togetherness, which I think is how radio and the wavelengths reaches across what can only be described as a troubled time in a troubled land, as a troubled moment in history.
Peter, I thank you, and I thank you for everything you're doing for us as well. We'll talk to you next week.
Okie dokie. See you then.
Touch of Rimsky-Korsakov's Russian Easter Overture in honor of this Easter week, as I offer you a couple of options for pursuing your things online. 42nd Street Moon on Tuesdays and Fridays is offering a virtual moon, so check out their Facebook page. And as you heard earlier, Brian Copeland is also offering some virtual shows for more people than he's probably played at the Marsh ever in one night, that's for sure. The San Francisco Symphony and has announced that they are going to be streaming their acclaimed productions with MTT Keeping Score, so check them out on YouTube. While it will not be opening the Magic Flute in April, Opera San Jose has announced something all opera patrons can enjoy at home. Instead, the free live stream viewing of its breathtaking 2011 production of Mozart's first dramatic masterpiece, the rarely produced Idomeneo, King of Crete. OperaSJ.org for more information on that. In the weeks ahead, we hope to involve some of our local theater companies for some radio dramas to connect them by Zoom or some other way, so entertain you here as part of Open Air. In the meantime, TheaterWorks Silicon Valley's production of Pride and Prejudice will still be available to stream. Go to streamingmusicals.com. Lots to do virtually here on the performing arts fronts, and if you can, offer some coin to the organizations that are in peril, really, as this crisis continues. And if you're a regular subscriber to the opera or ballet or even some of the smaller organizations, consider donating your tickets and help them get through this. This has been Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. I'm David Latulli. Thank you so much for getting through this with me in this new virtual world, flying solo, engaging people from around the corner and around the world now by Zoom, by Skype, by phone as well. If you've got someone you'd like featured during this time of crisis in the arts front, by all means, send me an email. I'm david@kalw.org. As always, our shows are archived at kalw.org. My thanks to Niels Swinkels, a virtual wave to him, for helping produce the show. Be well.